Dear Prime Minister, the date on the letter was March 21, 1975. Dear Mr. Prime Minister, the President wrote, I am writing to convey my deep disappointment. The writer, Gerald Ford. The recipient, Yitzhak Rabin. The episode is familiar to anyone who has delved even slightly into the history of U.S.-Israel relations. It remains one of the most significant crises in the history of the alliance. 2 years after the Yom Kippur War, and 2 years before Anwar Sadat's historic visit to Jerusalem, the Ford administration was pressing Israel to accept Secretary of State Henry Kissinger's proposal for an interim agreement with Egypt. Everyone remembered the war, the historic visit was still beyond anyone's imagination. Rabin dug in on his conditions. The Egyptians dug in on theirs. Kissinger believed the Egyptians were right. The Israeli government maneuvered and stonewalled. Frustrated, Kissinger cut his Middle East trip short and flew home. An angry Ford announced a reassessment of the bilateral relationship. You will be informed of our decisions, Ford wrote to Rabin. In other words, you will have no part in this. We will debate, we will decide, and you will be notified. The president's letter to the prime minister was preceded by a memorandum from the deputy national security advisor Brent Scowcroft to President Ford. It bore the exact same date, March 21. The basic problem remains that Israel is dealing with this issue largely as a matter of domestic politics. They have nailed themselves to propositions they could not fulfill and are jeopardizing our entire position in the Middle East in the pursuit of entirely marginal points, Scowcroft wrote. It was not the first time, nor would it be the last, that Scowcroft viewed Israeli policy as an obstacle in America's path. It is also right to speak truth, even when it may be inconvenient, to our closest of allies, he wrote a decade ago, when the Obama administration was pressing Israel to advance on the Palestinian track. Kissinger had taught him that Israel has no foreign policy, only domestic politics. Scowcroft was convinced. Irrelevant relevancy. This historical moment is worth recalling because of how it ended. We will get to the ending shortly, but first, let us look at recent events. Negotiations between the U.S. and Iran, conducted by energetic intermediaries while Israel was largely sidelined, have concluded with an agreement. It includes the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, which is what President Donald Trump wanted. It includes lifting the blockade on Iran, which is what Tehran wanted. And it includes a timetable for discussions on the nuclear issue. That is all. A timetable, the Americans say, or at least the president says, that the Iranians have already agreed to dilute enriched uranium on their soil. But the Iranians say they agreed to no such thing. There will be negotiations. The bottom line, the only achievement attributable to the war is tactical, the degradation of certain Iranian military capabilities. They have fewer missiles, launchers, ships, and radar. It will take them time to rebuild. Strategically, however, nothing has been achieved. If anything, the Iranians have gained leverage. In exchange for reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which was open until the war began, they are receiving concessions. This is an implicit recognition of their power to open and close it, and the geopolitical leverage that flows from that. That is not all. On the path to this agreement, Israel came under fire from Hezbollah in Lebanon. It retaliated, as it threatened it would, with a strike in Beirut. The Iranians threatened to strike Israel with missiles. Trump saw a threat to his deal. His response closely mirrored Ford's 1975 letter. Of course, Ford had his style, a formal letter with a structured threat of reassessment. Trump has a different style, tweets, leaks, interviews, and furious phone calls. He has no f-ing judgment, the president reportedly said of the Israeli prime minister. He's difficult. One could practically hear him thinking exactly what Scowcroft wrote in that old memo. Israel is dealing with this issue largely as a matter of domestic politics. They are jeopardizing our entire position in the Middle East. What happened to Ford? On May 22, exactly 2 months after declaring the process of reassessment, the president received a letter signed by 76 U.S. senators. We urge you to make it clear, as we do, that the United States acting in its own national interests stands firmly with Israel in the search for peace and future negotiations, and that this premise is the basis of the current reassessment of U.S. policy in the Middle East. To say the president disliked the way Israel mobilized its friends in Washington to pressure the White House would be an understatement. It's not helpful, pressure of this kind, the president told Rabin and his ambassador, Simcha Dinitz, when they visited the White House. He also feigned personal offense. You know me, he told Rabin, who had served as ambassador to Washington before becoming prime minister. We worked together closely, you should have no doubt about my commitment to Israel. The complaint was recorded in the minutes. The reassessment ultimately yielded nothing. Standing against the president were Senators Henry, Scoop, Jackson, D. Wash, Clifford Case, RNJ, Jacob Javits, RNY, Birch Bayh, D. Eind, Hubert Humphrey, D. Min, Ted Kennedy, D. Mass, Walter Mondale, D. Min, Ed Muskie, D. Main, Barry Goldwater, R. Ariz, Strom Thurmond, RSC, Lloyd Benson, D. Texas, and Stuart Symington, D. Miss. The list included a former vice president, a former presidential nominee, a future nominee and powerful leaders from both parties. Ford flexed a muscle. Israel flexed a countermuscle. It was tense, but the cord did not snap. It left a scratch, but relations returned to normal, until the next crisis. Yet none of this historical precedent applies to the current crisis, and the fact that it is irrelevant is highly relevant to understanding Israel's present situation. Against Ford, Israel's allies could mobilize 76 senators. Against Trump, in the current scenario, it is doubtful they could mobilize 6. From the outset, there was no appetite within the Democratic Party for war against Iran. Its leadership believes Netanyahu dragged the U.S. into an unnecessary conflict, blaming him no less than they blame Trump. Within the Republican Party, almost no one is willing to challenge the president. Even Republican leaders who believe Trump conceded too quickly in negotiations, or accepted an agreement devoid of significant achievements, will hesitate to break ranks. Perhaps 2, 3, or 4 might. But getting 6 signatures on a letter like the one sent to Ford would be a challenge. This represents a profound shift in Israel's standing in Washington. And it is a dangerous shift for a country that has always strived to rely on a multi-layered relationship. Israel always sought friends on both sides of the aisle, cultivating supporters in the administration, Congress, the military, intelligence agencies, think tanks, the press, and philanthropic foundations. Those friends still exist. Israel still has allies in all these places. But they are fewer than before, less powerful than before, and far less willing to confront a president determined to reach agreements whose consequences for Israel are severe. Israel has been left alone with Trump. This works in its favor when he decides, contrary to public opinion, to launch a bombing campaign across Iran. It works less in its favor when he decides, without consulting Israel, to dictate terms of engagement in Lebanon that prevent Israel from achieving its necessary objectives. Overplaying a hand, the almost inescapable conclusion from the current situation in Iran writes itself. Israel was too successful. It was too successful in Lebanon in the autumn of 2024, when it eliminated Hezbollah's top leadership and paralyzed the organization. It was too successful when it controlled the skies over Iran in the spring of 2025 during the first war. Instead of celebrating the success and seeking an exit, Israel developed more appetite. If this much success was possible, perhaps more could be achieved. One can criticize Trump. He lacks patience, lacks endurance, and lacks the willingness to make sacrifices to achieve long-term goals. One can equally criticize the Israeli leadership, chiefly Netanyahu, who dictates Israel's current course almost single-handedly. He has too much patience, too much endurance, and too much willingness to sacrifice to achieve his goals. Trump wants to wrap things up quickly and leave. Netanyahu wants to keep going and going and never leave. His rivals will assume this is the real problem, that he does not want to leave, politically speaking, and therefore seeks an endless war. But the problem may well be different. Netanyahu wants to achieve specific strategic and security achievements and refuses to settle for what has already been won, even after achieving a great deal. He refuses to settle even when it becomes clear that the cost of additional achievements outweighs their benefit. It is said that Trump did not account for the possibility that the Iranians would close the Strait of Hormuz. If so, it represents an unacceptable blindness. Former Air Force Commander Amir Eshel noted recently, at the JPPI annual conference early this week, that in every exercise and war game he participated in over the past two decades, the closure of the strait was always on the table. Israel suffered from the same blindness when it failed to account for Trump's unpredictable personality. The sudden slamming of the door on the war, the abrupt halt in Lebanon, the bluntness directed at Netanyahu, all of these should have been anticipated in Israel's war games. Unless, of course, Netanyahu managed to convince not only himself but everyone around him that through sheer force of personality, he could persuade the American president to assent to any move, on any timeline, regardless of the intermediate costs. Israel has run into a strategic problem. That is the most important development of the week. Netanyahu has run into a political problem. That is the less important development of the week. Israel has concluded a round of war aimed at weakening Iran, only to finish with Iran stronger in many respects. Hezbollah is stronger too. It is premature to predict how Israel will overcome this setback, but it must find a way. Meanwhile, Netanyahu has lost two of his primary political assets. First, the claim that he is the only leader knowledgeable and determined enough to confront Iran. He can still argue his political rivals would have fared worse, but he can no longer claim success. Second, he may have lost Trump as a political asset. Trump previously served Netanyahu's narrative in three ways. The claim that, Trump and I are close friends, the claim that, I know how to stand up to Washington, and the claim that, Trump demands I be granted amnesty, leaving domestic critics with no choice but to comply. Can he still make these claims? It would not be easy. Were we all wrong? It is never easy to admit a mistake. It is difficult for an individual, a public, a community or a state. Researchers Lee Ross, Mark Lepper and Michael Hubbard demonstrated what they termed perseverance in self-perception and social perception. Their original research is fascinating, essentially confirming what we observe in daily life. Human beings cling to their beliefs even after it is proven beyond a doubt that they are wrong. If this holds true when there is no doubt, it is even harder when doubt exists. When it appears people might have been wrong or overdetermined, but the outcome is still ambiguous. It is hard for everyone, including Israelis. More than 80% of Israelis, and over 90% of Israeli Jews, supported the war effort, dubbed here, the Lion's Roar. Today, the majority believe it fell short of its goals. In fact, even before the deal was announced, 64% of Israeli Jews already stated it would be bad for Israel. Another 25% said it was too early to tell. It is fair to assume subsequent polling will show an even higher percentage of Israelis viewing the agreement as a bad one. Israel went to war with specific objectives. Some were fully declared, such as removing enriched uranium from Iran. Others were partially declared, like what the prime minister termed, creating the conditions for regime change in Iran, which, as Eshel put it, amounts to wishing for an outcome without willing the means. Other goals were widely agreed upon, severing Iran's ties with its terrorist proxies and halting its missile program. How many of these goals were achieved? We must avoid binary conclusions. The fact that many goals were not met does not mean the war was devoid of achievements. The missile program was damaged. While it can be rebuilt, the damage is real and reconstruction will take time. The nuclear program was also hit. There were numerous tactical successes against Iran that will require the regime to invest significant time and effort to recover from. Yet nations do not launch wars for tactical successes. They launch them for strategic objectives. Those, Israel did not achieve. Not regime change, not a permanent end to the nuclear threat, not the elimination of the missile threat and not the dismantling of the proxy network. A large share of the responsibility for this failure rests with President Trump. He hoped for a quick victory, and when it did not materialize, he quickly grew impatient and capitulated. He continues to maintain that he will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. Perhaps he means it. But Biden, Obama, Bush and Clinton all said the same before him. none of them went to war to ensure it, and none of them tested Iran's endurance only to back down. This brings us back to the difficulty of changing one's mind. When does the moment arrive for an Israeli to say, I supported going to war, and I was wrong? This question applies to 9 out of 10 Israeli Jews. It is easy to say the war's goals were not achieved. While unsettling, it is an objective statement. The failure can be blamed on the state, the prime minister, the IDF, or the American president. They made the decisions that led to this outcome. It is far more difficult to say, I misjudged the situation, too. I believed this war was the right course, which means I believed the goals were attainable, and I fell into the same trap of exaggerated expectations. How many Israelis are actually admitting a mistake? JPPI polling from last week offers some surprising data. We found almost no Israelis who supported the war now claiming they never did. There is very little revisionist amnesia. About a fifth of all Israelis, and about a tenth of Jewish respondents, said, I did not support the war. Those numbers match the initial data, meaning those who supported the intervention still acknowledge their initial stance. But when asked whether, in light of the results, their support was a mistake, only a fifth of those supporters agreed. 7% of total respondents said they supported the war and now think they were wrong. Another 13% chose a softer but similarly aligned option. I supported the war, and I am not sure it was the right position. This means a large majority of Israelis still believe that supporting the war, despite the unsatisfactory outcome, was the correct decision. Among those who identify with the political right, 96% maintain they were correct to support it. Those who reflect on whether they were wrong are found primarily in the center and center-left. Their support for the war at its inception was very high. Now they are debating whether they were swept up in the initial enthusiasm, the roar of the jets, the shock value of the bombings, the elimination of the Iranian leadership and the total control of Iranian airspace. These Israelis are saying, we supported it, and perhaps we were wrong. That is a difficult admission. It implies a degree of understanding, perhaps even acceptance, of the logic that led Israel's leadership into what has turned out to be a miscalculation. Netanyahu bears the ultimate responsibility for balancing Israel's goals against its means, and its ability to use those means within a given time frame. Netanyahu assessed the means, defined the goals and, in hindsight, his calculus appears to have been flawed. Only time will tell how much this will hurt him in the coming elections in the fall. But Netanyahu did not err alone. The majority of Israelis erred with him. We knew what Israel was capable of doing. We had witnessed those capabilities during the previous conflict a year earlier. We knew which objectives mattered to Israel. We also knew the American president, his strengths and his flaws. We saw the full picture, and almost all of us concluded that, given that picture, it was right for Israel to embark on this joint campaign with the United States against Iran. If it was a mistake, it was our mistake too. This does not diminish the responsibility of the leadership, whose duty it is to weigh fateful decisions like war with the utmost gravity. But it does reveal something about our collective state of mind, our capacity for assessment, our dangerous tendency to get swept up in the moment and our persistent difficulty in accurately gauging the obstacles on the path to victory. Shmuel Rosner is senior political editor. For more analysis of Israeli and international politics, visit Rosner's domain at jewishjournal.com/rosnersdomain.